Hello and welcome to Little Fictions on Air. I'm Kate Liston Mills, your host. Before I introduce today's story, I'd like to remind you that all of our past episodes are available online. Just go to the Audio Lounge section on the Spineless Wonders website at www.shortaustralianstories.com.au. Our previous Little Fictions episodes are there for you to listen to or download. And we are also hosting our audio book club again. The links are on the website and it is easily accessed via our Facebook account. Please do join us, as I am sure you will find it is a fun and relaxed way to chat with other listeners about the stories and the ideas they raise. Occasionally, our actors and authors drop into our book club meetings, which is a great way for us to get their perspective on the story or acting process. And finally, if you have any feedback for us about the show, please email us at info@shortaustralianstories.com.au. Thank you. In today's episode, we will listen to a short fiction by S.J. Finn. Finn has published work in many forms, including short story, novel, and poetry, and she has been published in anthologies and journals including Sleeper's Almanac, Island Magazine, Kill Your Darlings, and the Overland Journal. Her work has been shortlisted for the Age Short Story Competition and has been runner-up in many other competitions, including the Carmel Bird Short Story Competition. It is this story that we will listen to today, Paper Anniversary, that's been included in the Escape Anthology published by Spineless Wonders. Traditionally, the first year of a marriage is marked by giving gifts of paper, and it is thought to date back to the Victorian era. There are many conflicting ideas about why the first anniversary is paper. It might be because paper is inexpensive, yet provides the meaning of eternity through writing. Or perhaps that it represents a blank page where stories can be written. Other thoughts around the significance of paper for the first year anniversary is that writing is eternal and should be representative of marriage in that sense. Thinking about these themes as you listen to today's story may assist you in understanding the protagonist's thoughts and actions when she is confronted by what, for her, is the unforgivable actions of her partner. In many ways, she is representative of today's conflicted Western woman, caught somewhere between traditional roles, modern ideals, and self-awareness. The push and pull of these roles can be exciting and difficult to navigate. However, I think she gives us hope that we can make decisions that are not completely chained to old traditions. Decisions that will eventually lead to good things because they are made out of thoughtfulness and self-respect. Here is Paper Anniversary by S.J. Finn.
If she hadn't come home early, she wouldn't have seen it, wouldn't have pulled it from the letterbox. Usually he collects the mail, since most evenings he arrives at their apartment before her. Sometimes he's even done a few chores, the dishes, a load of washing, the vacuuming. Groovy young executive, complete with apron and rubber gloves. Best of all, he greets her with a drink. They generally have something in the house, vodka, bourbon, something to mix it with. Soda, cranberry juice, tonic. She can put her feet up for half an hour, although more often than not they sit at the table smoking cigarettes and laughing about things that have happened during the day. That's when she gets started on dinner. It is, after all, what they've agreed on. Oh, and he hands her the mail, unopened. Sometimes they joke about it, that with the money she saved them by being in charge of things, she could buy herself a solid gold letter opener. It'd be just the thing for the job. But what does it matter how she came upon it? This flimsy but startling bank statement. Here it is, on their special day, their anniversary, their very first one-year anniversary. And not for a second did anyone at work mind her heading off to prepare the special meal for the occasion, especially as she'd been planning it for weeks. A surprise, the candlelit dinner, an expensive rack of lamb, the notebook and matching envelopes with their names and address printed on them, the music she planned to play from their CD collection. And here she is, sitting with a drink she's mixed for herself and everything done, the meal prepared and ready to go in the oven, the table set, including the candles in their holders, the music of Nina Simone crooning soothingly in the background. So how could all this celebration have become so soured after opening just one piece of mail? She takes a bigger mouthful from the glass than she intends. It dribbles down her chin and she has to catch it with the back of her hand, push it back over her bottom lip. She gets up, goes to the French doors at the front of their place to check if he has driven up. It's a pointless distraction. She can't see all the cars in the street anyway. She goes back to the table. She has to think. Mel will be home soon. You know not everything's going to be perfect, not all of the time. You've heard that so often from older people, hell from everyone, and you don't want to be hasty. Even your mother has reiterated how full of compromise her and your dad's relationship is. Nobody should expect it's going to be easy, she'd said. You have to learn to bend, to be flexible. Added to that, you've always said people can achieve pretty much anything they put their minds to, and Mal had decided he wanted to do this, to rein things in, to get control of his expenditure. It's not just for you, he'd said, without prompting. Or us, for that matter. No, I'm doing it for myself. You dealt with it so well, or so you thought. Actually, you'd congratulated yourself. If only you could be that gentle and encouraging, that pragmatic and problem-solving all the time. It's something that can be fixed, you'd said. We just need some simple rules, a little tightening of the belt, and if we work together. It would have been silly not to help him. It's the amount of debt he's got himself into which was making it impossible for him to get his head clear of things. He just needed a few strategies put in place. The matter would look after itself then, as easy as that. The phone rings, makes her jerk up from the paper statement. Natalie? It's Margot from the office. Sorry to ring. Just a quick question in regards to a Mrs. Rosa L'Aquilina. Seemed to have misplaced the latest set of plans with council's stamp on them. She has to think, reset her brain, such is the fugue which has descended on her. Her gaze drifts to the table with its candles. She loves this flat so much. It's so homely with her second-hand knick-knacks and posters, photos she's stuck in old frames and hung on the walls. It's possible they're filed under A. I noticed George did that once before. Something about the capital letter thing. They did come in. I remember seeing them. You're a gem, Nat. Thanks. Preparations going well? For a moment, caught like this, she can't think what preparations Margot might be referring to. Her mind churns. Then she remembers and imagines saying, "Preparations? Are you kidding? Separation is what's going on here." But she doesn't say that, of course. She says, "Yes, thanks. It all looks lovely. Paper anniversary." Margot's voice slips into sentimentality. If I could go back, I'd celebrate each and every anniversary with Greg according to the tradition. You could do that, you know. It would be amazing to look back on that one day. What you lack is a discerning eye. How could you have been taken in so easily? You should have been awake to it at Christmas. all those expensive gifts he bought you, a silk scarf, 2 pairs of silver earrings, a pearl-handled manicure set. It wasn't necessary, and the two of you had discussed presents, deciding to forgo them and save your money, put it towards something substantial, a holiday, the deposit for your own unit. You'd let it go that day, but you did tackle it before the new year arrived, and he apologised, saying that because you were so beautiful and he'd received such a good bonus, he couldn't resist. He'd even offered to take the presents back, get a refund. You should have let him, but he'd cajoled you and sworn he'd keep to his word in the future, so you let it go. Now you see the items here, listed on this credit card account, an account you've never seen before, and it occurs to you there might be others, others you haven't seen, and you curse because you should have followed things up more thoroughly, because you've been kidding yourself. Except it's him who's been kidding you. You have to remember that, and after everything you talked about. Yes, you'd been calm, but in the year leading up to the wedding, you'd also been clear. If he didn't do something about his finances, well, there was just no way the two of you had a future. Not together. You just didn't want to live like that. But I will, he'd said, his eyes drawn up in a puppy dog plea. I want to. It was you who set up the payment schemes, $40 a week to this credit card, $40 to that one, and so on. You both earn a good wage, so the debts would be gone in a matter of 2, maybe 3 years. That didn't seem so far away, and you'd both decided. Then the two of you could plan a future. You haven't mentioned it, but you would like to have a baby, and there's a lot you'd like to do before that. You stop yourself. It's possible you've been too prescriptive. You know you have that tendency. Friends have told you. You're too careful, and you like to know exactly what's ahead. You've learnt to hide this to some degree, acknowledging that Mal's attitude to life, act now, think and pay later, has helped you to loosen up, helped to balance the books, so to speak, of your personality. It's often true, after all, that complementary relationships last longer. And on that score, you've imagined you'd been good for him too. His hedonistic, carefree ways couldn't go on endlessly, after all. Skiing trips to Japan, gambling in Las Vegas. Well, no one can do that and expect not to have to pay for it at all. A lot of holidays that Mal had had, he didn't even remember. Alcohol-fueled, they'd just passed in a blur. And what had he said after your modest honeymoon in Byron Bay? It was the best 2 weeks he'd ever had, and he could see now he'd wasted his money on all those long flights and expensive motels, spending his time with mates who, like him, he admitted, were in a drunken stupor. The thing is, it wasn't even his money. It belonged to the bank, and now you are paying it back. Except that you're not. Not when he'd agreed there'd be no new accounts. Not when he'd sworn he'd shown you everything, so that when you look again, down at these numbers, the zeros and percentage points, the lack of minus signs indicating payments, you know it's not just the money. It's the lack of honesty, the disregard, the total dearth of respect. Metaphorically, it's like one huge finger in the face. Fury has made it to Natalie's extremities, her movements becoming larger and a little clumsy because of it. She lumbers to the kitchen, and in a series of untidy grabs pours herself another vodka. She wonders where the rest of the bad news mail is. He must have hidden it, and she walks around the flat for a few minutes, opening drawers and looking in behind books on the bookshelves. Then, certain he must have destroyed it, she returns empty-handed to the table, telling herself he won't smooth-talk her again, that this tally here, the one right in front of her, is all she needs. And so she sits calmly, planning what she's going to say to him, but then she starts crying, and soon she's sobbing, great whoops of upset convulsing through her. You'd been worried before you met Mal that you might be left on the shelf. You'd had a few boyfriends when you were a teenager, but then, in your early 20s, the dates you went on didn't lead to anything, and after a while, even they had stopped. You first saw Mal at a bar at Docklands. He was buying a round of drinks and offered to pay for yours and your friends, since he was already spending a small fortune. You'd declined with a smile and a series of giggles, but your friend Anna had said yes please, and that in return, the two of you would help him carry the drinks back to his table. You were struck by his camaraderie with his friends, his ease. Everything about him was attractive, and at the end of the night he'd insisted on walking you up to the dock, hailing a cab, making sure you and Anna were safely on your way. You thought that might have been it, but the next day a large bunch of flowers had arrived and you realised that he must have remembered where you worked and found your address on the internet. And as you got to know him, it couldn't be denied. Mal had a certain cheeky charm about him, a boyish enthusiasm that suited your young, careful quietness. The two of you seemed to fit. You never had to ask Mal for attention. He delivered it without question. There was just this one drawback, his tendency to deal with money with splayed fingers. Cash didn't just fall through his hands, it rushed. Natalie finds herself staring, eyes sore, head pounding at the clock. Any minute now he'll come through the door, and she will tell him it's over, that she's very sorry but everything has changed. His cute curiosity she now sees as wishy-washy, his promises and undertakings as manipulative. In fact, he has absolutely no backbone. His entire character suddenly appears to be based on how much he can prop it up with non-existent cash. But it's the depth of his deception that has unalterably tainted things. Inevitably, he'll lumber from one credit card to the other, probably surviving, but not the way she wishes him to, planning to purchase things, saving for them and then buying them, paying for all the things they own. That's what she wants. Not the other way round. You should have realised why his mother was always talking about budgets to the two of you when you went there. You joked with her about how bad he was at tallying his input with his output, and that's why you'd taken over the finances for the time being, just until things got back on track. Always a mystery to us, she'd said. Wasn't it, Alan? She'd wanted confirmation from her husband, and now you think there'd been something odd about that as well. The way he'd hardly answered her, an aha of agreement, but nothing more, a fobbing off really, and now you wonder about this, whether it was a backhanded way of condoning Mal's behaviour, a way of saying, what does it really matter, that in the end, women get what they want, prevail eventually, and perhaps that's how things are in Mal's family, the men make messes and the women fix them up, which probably, certainly at first, the men appreciate. Perhaps even Mal's father had valued it once, just like Mal does now. But after a while, just like Mal might in the future, he began to resent it, so that it produced the kind of offhand response she'd witnessed, the same kind of offhand response which will creep into Mal's repertoire as well, the whole thing becoming a sticking point, and then a sticky membrane between them, keeping them together while driving them apart. That visit had taken place a couple of weeks before the wedding. You'd been discussing the savings you'd made by making your own place cards and dressing the tables yourself, by choosing to have a simpler affair than other friends' weddings. "What do we need all the trimmings for?" you'd said to Mal's mum. "In the end, it's the quality of the union that's important." Her head up, Natalie huffs a substantial exhale from her nostrils, a kind of laugh. Why is she fighting so hard, struggling every day to fix something she didn't break? It isn't merely hard or difficult, it's closer to impossible. He doesn't want to change. The debt, He's simply gone out and got another credit card to carry it on. She would recognise the number of the account otherwise, the odd 666 in the middle, the devil's number. It stands out after all. And the grand total that's there, the deficit of $8,000 spent in less than 7 months. He probably has others as well, but it doesn't matter. This one is enough. Just last week he'd used it again. The last entry was made at a jeweller's, and she has absolutely no doubt he will be bringing the item, whatever had it cost, over $500, home this evening to give her. She's shaking as she gets up from her seat at the table, is hollowed out from the last half hour. In her bedroom she takes a small backpack from her wardrobe, an old tatty thing with a couple of broken zips. She packs herself a change of clothing, her phone and wallet, her toothbrush from the bathroom. Then taking the key that opens the back gate, she goes out the back door and across the yard, letting herself into the laneway where she can breathe a little easier. Ahead at the end of the alley, she can see cars passing. There she'll hail a cab, get herself to her good friend Anna's. And as she's walking, something she almost can't believe, she feels herself getting lighter. With every step, she feels her feet lift a little higher and her head rise a little further. And she hears the clatter of her shoes, the rhythm they are playing as they strike the bluestones. It sounds like a machine in a factory producing something over and over again, spitting it out. Or perhaps it's the exaggerated noise of her keyboard going full pelt under her fingertips that she's reminded of. And as she listens, she lets the rhythm carry her towards the road, her heart beating with her stride like a metronome methodically keeping pace. But it's her feet, swinging in perfect oscillation, that grips her. They're clicking and clattering, like a highly ordered operation being completed to its natural and proper end.
That was Paper Anniversary, read and written by S.J. Finn. So, what did you think of Natalie? The story is told from the perspective of her own interior thoughts, occasionally interrupted by the outside world. We immediately delve inside Natalie's internal life. It is this way that we understand the context of her final decision. Even if we can't all relate firsthand to this exact situation, we all can relate to forms of trust being broken and personal boundaries being crossed. Natalie is a capable, self-aware young woman. She wants to be loved and believed. She had in place mechanisms to protect herself from the one drawback about Mal she felt could jeopardize their marriage. She had such faith in how well her and Mal had constructed and organized this plan that finding he hadn't stuck to it not only shook her faith in Mal, but it shook her faith in herself. Understanding the difference between societal expectations and our own personal well-being can be difficult to navigate. Natalie seems to be having a conversation with herself about why she is with Mal. Part of the reason she is in a relationship with him is about love and a lifelong commitment based on trust. However, we come to understand that Natalie may have decided to settle on a relationship with Mal because she was afraid of being alone. While we all need love and understand that compromise is involved in any intimate relationship, it shouldn't be at the cost of our own happiness. How people see marriage is dependent on the lenses they are using to view it. We all know that marriage is often bound to religion. Therefore, it has many expectations attached to it, dependent on the religion the vows are made under. However, they are still difficult to let go of for many people, even those of us who are not particularly religious. we find Natalie in the midst of learning something important about herself and not being fearful of walking away from a marriage that will inevitably make her deeply unhappy. However you may view marriage, I'm sure you are able to comprehend the bravery of Natalie's decision. She leaves something that meant many things for her. It meant love, compromise, and trust. Her love for herself and her strong sense of personal respect allowed her the clarity to know what was best for her at the end. One of the quotes on S.J. Finn's website is from Virginia Woolf's papers, which were made into the book A Room of One's Own. I'll read you a quote now. If we escape a little from the common sitting room and see human beings not always in their relation to each other, but in relation to reality, and the sky too, and the trees, or whatever it may be in themselves, if we look past Milton's bogey, for no human being should shut out the view. If we face the fact, for it is a fact, that there is no arm to cling to, but that we go alone, and that our relation is to the world of reality, and not only to the world of men and women, then the opportunity will come, and the dead poet who was Shakespeare's sister will put on the body which she has so often laid down. As for her coming without that preparation, without that determination, that when she is born again, she shall find it possible to live and write her poetry, I maintain that she would come if we worked for her, and that so too work, even in poverty and obscurity, is worthwhile. That is Virginia Woolf, 1984. So can you find Natalie in that quote? She chooses to go alone in her world. She is determined to live how she wants to live, how she needs to live, even if that means being alone. Natalie does not want to be using her money or time to pay for Mal's bad habits, fixing something she didn't break. Nor does she want to remain in a marriage where she no longer trusts her partner. She walks away with her head held high, feeling free. And that's all we have time for today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Little Fictions on Air is produced by Bronwyn Meehan. The production assistant is Caddy Hansen. I'm Kate Liston Mills. Please join me again for Little Fictions on Air.